seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday, the 19th of April in the glorious future year of 2025, and the first time I said that, I forgot to unmute my mic. Now, today is, in both the Eastern and Western Christian worlds, which does not happen every year, Holy Saturday. Yesterday was Good Friday. If you listen to Tin's show, he did some religious music. Which, of course, is interesting because Good Friday is, at least from a ritual perspective in Christianity, the opposite of a holiday. It is the least holy day of the year. In a Catholic church, the Eucharist is taken away, Mass cannot be said, the sanctuary lamps are snuffed out because it is... Now, the theology is more complex than this, but in a ritualistic sense, it is the one day of the year that there is no God. It is the one day of the year when God is dead and in hell. Which I personally find fascinating. Now... The Jews also have a Passover going on, and it's always nice when those things sync up as they are supposed to. But that's nothing resembling what I'm here to talk to you about today. What am I here to talk to you about today? No, I'm not going to talk about the draft. That one's just too easy. Instead, I thought that I would talk for a minute about the Star Drive. Whatever it is that will allow us to travel from our solar system to other star systems. Now, I don't regard this as a terribly urgent action item, for the simple reason that our sun doesn't look like it's going anywhere for the next few billion years, and there's a whole lot of stuff to explore and to exploit economically in this solar system alone. That I don't think there's any urgency at the moment about interstellar travel, although, of course, I could be wrong. Nevertheless, it's very interesting to speculate about. And, you know, we can talk about slower-than-light travel to the stars, but the one thing that's very clear about slower-than-light travel to the stars is even 1% of the speed of light is going to require really enormous energy per kilogram. Special relativity doesn't even enter into it at that point. Pure Newtonian physics will show you that the amount of energy per kilogram in something moving 1% of the speed of light is comparable to the energy per kilogram released in nuclear fusion. And what this really means, so far as I'm concerned, is that slower-than-light star travel is really something that only a civilization which has got to Kardashev Level 2, a civilization which is actively exploiting a large fraction of the energy from its home star, can realistically talk about. A star drive, on the other hand, sort of by definition, behaves some other way. Just exactly what that other way is, of course, we can't predict yet. But here's what I will predict for you. You know, physicists have begun talking seriously about this, and the first contender is the so-called Alcubierre drive, which it's not clear whether the physical principles implicit in its mathematics can be implemented in the real universe. And also, the energy it would require is still very, very large. But it shows you that there are conceptual pathways down which a star drive may be found. And what I think is this. I think that the conceptual breakthrough that will give us the star drive will come once the astrophysicists acknowledge that the dark matter and dark energy, which they are currently appealing to reconcile cosmological models with observation, are not compatible with each other, they're not compatible with local observations here in the solar system, and they're not compatible with special relativity. Now, do I have the least idea what that conceptual breakthrough is? No. Do I know how long it will take to go from conceptual breakthrough to practical realization? No. If we look at the steam turbine, you know, Heron of Alexandria built a toy steam turbine nearly 2,000 years before Charles Parsons built the first one that could be practically used. And as I've said before on this show, a significant part of that was limitations of material science. On the other hand, the first generation of electricity from nuclear fission was only a little more than 50 years after the discovery of the radioactivity of uranium by Becquerel. So Becquerel to EBR-1 is, you know, 53, 54 years. Heron of Alexandria, who may not have been the first to build a toy steam turbine, to Charles Parsons is more than 1,800 years. It's hard to say how long it will take from the discovery of the concept which gives us the star drive to an actual working star drive. I mean, there's a couple of things that we're pretty sure that the so-called dark matter, right, which is being brought in to explain the fact that galactic rotation is faster than it should be if the mass of the galaxy is the mass we can observe. And then dark energy is brought in to explain that the galaxies are moving farther apart faster than if they really were that massive. Right, these two things are contradictory. And what's more, if either of these two things were correct, then we ought to be able to observe it in our solar system. There's no reason why there wouldn't be dark matter in our solar system, but if there were dark matter in our solar system, then the effective gravitational constant that we measure from measuring the Earth, from watching the revolution of the moons of Jupiter, and that kind of thing, that value would be much higher. But we don't observe that, right? When we look at the gravitational constant as we calculate it from our solar system, and then we extend it to our galaxy as a whole, using, you know, assuming that the stars around the galaxy have pretty much the same ratio of mass to diameter and luminosity that our sun has, in other words, that our sun is a typical star of its size, and we can figure out the sizes of the other stars, right, and their planetary systems have similar characteristics and all that. In other words, that the laws of physics are the same in our solar system as they are generally in our galaxy, and generally in our galaxy as they are in other observable galaxies, the numbers don't add up. The galaxy has to be like 10 times as massive. But clearly that's not happening in our solar system, or we would just measure the planets 10 times more massive and everything would look normal throughout the universe. Something's very wrong here. Right. There's something fundamentally wrong in our astrophysics. And it can't just be that there's more ordinary matter than we think there is and we just can't see it either. Because the inflationary model of cosmology gives us a way to predict the amount of baryonic matter, matter produced of protons and neutrons, the familiar kind of matter, in the universe from the quantity of deuterium that we observe in the universe. And Now, that could be completely wrong, but if it is completely wrong, again, our whole cosmological model is wrong, because the deuterium prediction gives us roughly the amount of baryonic matter that we expect to observe and do observe in the universe as a whole. Something's very wrong. Now, it would be really fun to say, well, it's relativistic frame dragging, right? That it's actually an illusion. Because if we assume that and there's good evidence for this, that in the heart of most galaxies, there's a supermassive black hole with the mass of thousands or millions of times of our sun, and it's rotating very rapidly, hundreds of times a second or more. We know that a mass which is rotating under general relativity produces a sort of twisting, a torsional distortion in space-time, so that if you're orbiting around it in one direction, you seem to be going downhill all the time. If you're orbiting around in the other direction, you seem to be going uphill all the time. So you're going faster, let's say in the clockwise direction, than you are in the counterclockwise direction for an orbit with the same parameters. Right. Now, this is a fascinating idea. But if this was what was causing the galaxies to rotate faster than their observable mass would justify, then we'd expect to see that in our own solar system. We'd expect to see the motion of the planets being slower on one half of their orbit around the sun than on the other half of their orbit around the sun, in a way that's not correlated with their orbital eccentricity. And if that were happening, Kepler would have measured it, right? When Kepler calculated the orbit of Mars, he would have noticed that. And we don't actually see that. It's a pity, because it's a really fun idea. So, let's see. People in Com commenting that there is no Easter on the moon because of the Quatuor de Simeon controversy. The date of Easter, of course, is calculated based on the full moon and its relation to the vernal equinox. Now, let's see other things. Oh, a thing of note, I was going through my Anon Radio archives, and I did a little post for the recordings that I uploaded when I was at sea. They're all fairly brief. You just tune into you listen to the first part of each archive. But let me drop that in Com. So that link is sdf.org/l/2hi, sdf.org/lima/2hotel India, if you want my recordings from the MV Majestic Princess at sea between Fort Lauderdale and Barcelona. Now, a couple weeks back, there was some to-do about a nuclear battery announced by a company in China. And it really is quite nifty. It's what's called a beta-voltaic cell. And as I have described in earlier editions of this program, beta-voltaics are really great, because what they do is they slow down the electrons that are being expelled from a beta-active isotope, slow those down in a semiconductor junction in such a way as to turn the very high-energy single electron into a much larger number of lower-energy electrons, because it's very rarely that you need 500,000 volts at a very low current, but 3 to 5 volts at a much higher current, with roughly the same amount of energy, that's really desirable. And beta voltaics are at least an order of magnitude more efficient, typically, than radioisotope thermoelectric generators. And they're also very convenient for small sizes. It's just that up to now, it's been very challenging to build a successful beta voltaic generator because existing semiconductor junction materials don't like being bombarded with high energy electrons. Now, the Chinese say that they have basically the breakthrough that they've made is in using diamond as the semiconductor material, rather than older semiconductor materials such as silicon or silicon carbide or germanium or gallium arsenide. Apparently, the beta voltaic system using diamond semiconductor is very effective. And they think it'll last 50 years. It's very good, very good, very good material. Now, obviously, I want some of these for my electric-powered mechanical watches, my Accutrons and electronic balance wheel watches, so that I never have to change the battery. But for practical perspective, there's one really big glaring problem with this announcement. And that's their choice of radioactive material, the choice of their energy source, which is nickel-63. Nickel-63 is made by bombarding ordinary nickel with neutrons in a research reactor. And the world has a dire shortage of research reactors at the moment. There just are not enough reactors to produce all the isotopes that science wants, and industry wants, and medicine wants, and also to do fundamental physics research. We need a lot more research reactors. And even if we get those research reactors, the fact is that neutrons from a research reactor are inherently expensive. Neutrons from a power reactor are much cheaper because a great deal of the cost of the reactor is, you know, being paid for by the generation of electricity. In fact, the whole cost of the reactor, typically, is being paid for by the generation of electricity and byproduct heat. Okay, so problem is, most power reactor designs are not well adapted to irradiating stuff for isotope production. You can do it with a CANDU, but within certain limitations. So CANDU, for example, is the world's major source of cobalt-60 from power plants in Ontario. It is also possible to use CANDU for other kinds of irradiations, but it's not convenient for everything, particularly stuff that has to be irradiated at a short period. The neutron flux density in a CANDU is not ideal for all types of irradiations you want to do. So producing high specific activity nickel-63 is an expensive proposition, and that is going to keep these nuclear batteries from widespread use. Now, if you want cheap and widespread beta voltaic cells for all applications, which is something I'd certainly be in favor of, you're going to need to use beta-emitting isotopes recovered from nuclear waste, fission products. Strontium-90, of course, with its 28-year half-life, being the best from many points of view. If you want something with a softer energy spectrum, promethium may be your best bet, an artificial radioisotope, artificial element, right? Promethium and technetium are the two elements of the first 92 that essentially are only made in nuclear reactors, and both of them show up as fission products. Well, promethium, with a half-life of about 12 years, is a very good metallic source of moderate energy beta particles for this kind of application. So, but of course, its lifespan is a little shorter than you would prefer. Strontium 90 has a higher energy, which does mean more Bremsstrahlung X-rays, which means more of a shielding problem. So that is it's a wonderful breakthrough as far as the energy conversion is concerned, but I want to see it implemented with a fission product energy source rather than one that requires expensive research reactor neutrons. Next up on the docket, what do I want to talk about? Oh yes, you may have heard that there was a all-woman space flight the other day. This is one of Blue Origin's 20-minute suborbital hops. And I don't know where they get off on calling it, you know, a pioneering all-woman space flight. Because I'm just going to say one name for you here. Valentina Tereshkova. Right? One of the first handful of people to go into orbit around the Earth. Right? Went into orbit around the Earth all by her lonesome, in a one-person Vostok capsule, Valentina Tereshkova, actually orbited the Earth, not just a suborbital hop. And you have to admit that a spaceflight on which there is one person, and that person is a woman, fits the definition of an all-woman spaceflight. I am, by the way, going to mention, what was Valentina Tereshkova's great qualification for this? Well, the answer was she was the highest rated female parachute jumper in the Soviet Union. And of course, the Vostok capsules did not land with the cosmonaut on board. They decided that would be too rough, and so the cosmonaut ejected at about 30,000 meters and parachuted down separately from the capsule. And so Valentina Tereshkova, being the highest rated woman parachute jumper in the Soviet Union, was a natural pick. And of course, the way the Soviet Union worked, she had a job in a parachute factory. it really gives you confidence in the product of the factory when one of the people who's employed there is using those products to jump from altitudes, you know, up to and including space itself. Let's see. What next? So, speaking of factories in countries, I'm going to talk just a little bit more about tariff and trade policy, trade barriers other than tariffs, and so on. And relevant, the old phrase, de minimis non curat lex, the law takes no note of trifles, that for the longest time you could mail something to another country without even requiring a customs declaration. And then in more recent years, they've required a customs declaration, but you know, the value of the package is relatively small. There's no actual duty charged. Well, that has changed a lot recently. In particular, in Germany, they have started charging duty on the package, but also VAT on the postage, which I think is a dreadful idea. And even so, I have seen ads in Munich for the things like Temu and Wish. And the great problem with things like Temu and Wish, which exist specifically by abusing the what's known as the de minimis exception, in other words, that nobody bothers to charge tariff, right, import duty, except on large commercial shipments consigned to a merchant who's going to resell them. The problem with things like Temu and Wish is that you have no idea what you're going to get. Now, you may say, you know, when I go to the store and I buy an electric toothbrush, it says made in China. Why shouldn't I just buy it directly from China at 1/10 of the price? Well, the answer to that question is that wealthy Chinese people go to Japan to buy Chinese-made goods at retail. Because they know that Chinese-made goods, which have been consigned to a Japanese retailer, the Japanese retailer is not going to sell them unless they meet certain health and safety standards, fire code, you know, chemical safety, all this other thing. That the very, you know, and in some cases, the, quote, export quality Chinese goods, you know, it's one factory, it's one production line, and they test the goods, whatever they are, and select out the better ones, and those get packed up and shipped for export, and the remaining ones wind up in the home market. So if you really think that you can buy Chinese home market goods and have them be as good as the Chinese-made goods which you buy in your local store, you may be wrong. And you may be wrong in a way which causes effects such as house fires, because the Chinese-made goods, Chinese home market goods, have not been tested and certified to your local fire safety fire code standards. This is a genuine concern, and it's not a thing I think people are talking about enough, not a thing people are thinking about enough. Now, on the other hand, people are saying some truly stupid things like, oh, well, you could never afford an iPhone made in America. To which I say, that doesn't actually make any sense. Because the thing is, firstly, many people who have iPhones aren't buying them at retail price to begin with. They're getting them under some contract with their mobile phone carrier. And so they don't see the price of the iPhone. Now, the price of the iPhone and the manufacturing cost of the iPhone are not two quantities that are closely coupled in any case. But we know that Apple has been in the habit of pushing software updates which degrade the performance of older iPhones. The plain fact is that if, in a putative, hypothetical US-made iPhone economy, presumably, yeah, it's more expensive. It might be two or three times more expensive. But the thing is, this would never really happen because Apple's whole business model is to push people to buy the new one. Right. A two to three times more expensive iPhone is an iPhone which you're holding on to for longer to amortize the initial cost. It's an iPhone which they're not going to be able to push those degrading software updates and so on. So the whole concept of a US-made iPhone being too expensive, it really falls down because the economics of the iPhone are based on driving you to get the new model all the time. That it's completely feasible, in principle, to have a durable iPhone, but it doesn't make sense in terms of Apple's business model. Now, what else is there to say? I did want to have just one brief note. I've talked in the past about the gold standard, its utility, its downsides, and I have said that it might be possible to implement a gold-based currency model or a gold-tied currency model in a modern economy without serious damage and danger. The question is, why would you want to do that? And I think the answer is, it's the sort of thing you would do in a national economy which had suffered a serious crisis of confidence. Because ultimately, confidence is what keeps currencies in circulation. And if people aren't confident in your national economy, if they aren't confident in your government, then maybe gold is the direction you want to go, at least temporarily. And how are you going to do that? Well, you're not going to have gold coins in circulation, probably, unless you're a fairly small country. Because the volume of business in a modern economy is very large. And as we've already discussed, the fluctuations that can happen in a credit currency economy can completely swamp the amount of gold that you have. Instead, you'd probably have possibly a gold coinage or possibly gold bullion basis where your treasury holds a large quantity of it and publishes every week a buying price and a selling price, and there is a import duty that has to be paid in gold to keep up the value, or to keep up the gold reserve fund. And when the people start cashing in too much of the local currency, so the gold reserve fund dips below a certain amount, the treasury stops paying out, but the gold tariff continues being collected, and so eventually it gets replenished. Anyway, since...